Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is the third edition of this podcast since I've been resurrected, thanks to Matthew Heimbeck and his friends. And I truly appreciate what they've done for me. There was a long period of time where I wasn't recording, but now, thanks to them, I'm back. And today, I want to talk about something that needs to be talked about a bit more. The social experiment, you might want to call it, of Likud. Likud is in that part of Russia where Belarus, or Russia, and Ukraine kind of intersect, you know, vaguely around Chernobyl, where the Bryansk Forest is. It was a nationalist, socialist experiment done for a few years under German occupation, and with tremendous success under with the indirect control of Bronislaw Kaminsky, who was their commander both formally and informally. But before that, though, I want to say a few things in terms of general announcements. Number one, as you all know, I do this on behalf of the Barnes Review, has been my employer for many, many years. And, now we are in the process of reorganizing, consolidating our forces, cooperating with many different organizations, the Traditionalist Workers' Party being one. But there are many others, and rebuilding and consolidating our assets. And I've been hired just 2 months ago now as senior researcher to continue this process. And so the work of Willis Cardo and Michael Collins Piper will continue. The three of us who are in charge of this have worked together for a long time, have known each other since 1999 when we were all hired, and trust each other, which is very, very important. Number two, the Barnes Review was represented at the local meeting, a Philadelphia meeting of the Traditionalist Workers' Party on Saturday, April 30th, 2016, which, as I record here now, was 3 days ago. I presented a paper there, but because it was more informal, more concerned with the nuts and bolts of building a party and movement, I kind of altered my academic approach and just, you know, dealt with the personal and basically political issues that we had to face, especially given the Trump phenomenon, as well as the positive things that are happening abroad. You know, ultimately, my thesis was that for the first time in my life, I can say that I'm optimistic. Donald Trump in America, for all his many, many, many flaws, has now brought nationalism, both in terms of economics, in terms of ethnicity and race, and has made it mainstream. He's doing what Buchanan tried to do in 1992. Things weren't that bad quite yet, so Buchanan failed, at least for temporarily. But now Trump is taking over where he has left off. Things are so bad in terms of economics, in terms of manipulation of the media. The, you know, most of the economic statistics that you read about are false. Unemployment, for example, thanks to Paul Craig Roberts, opened our eyes to how that's manipulated. So they only use the U3 measure, unemployment 3, the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only deals with those people who are collecting benefits. That's what the unemployment figure that they use officially refers to. If you include those who simply cannot find a job, that number goes up. When you include those who simply have given up, when you include those who are not on benefits, but simply are just taking odd jobs here and there. You know, all of this, you take all of these people together, and American unemployment is more like 30%, rather than the official figure now, which is absolutely ridiculous. And because of these economic realities, it's now mainstream to openly condemn this system. One of the things that I'm learning, both in my position at the Barnes Review as well as being involved in the traditionalist Workers' Party and movement, is that to be extreme, that is to say, in comparison to the ridiculous left-right paradigm that dominates American thinking, is no longer a problem. Believe it or not, you have these kind of theories and ideologies that I've been dealing with on this show and have been writing about and reading about my entire adult life. These are getting mainstream now. So to think that extremist rhetoric somehow will make someone unelectable is ridiculous. And the opposite is true. This is what people are hungering for. I'm always surprised about how many people this podcast draws and has drawn over the years. And I needed to be told, I need to learn for myself that people are hungering for this kind of thing. My generation, you know, I'm 44, but those much younger than me, we started off empty. The industrial base of America has been hollowed out. There is no civic unity. There is no economic purpose. There certainly is no religious unity. There is no ethnic or racial unity. There is no unity, even when it comes to the most fundamental elements of basic moral thinking. And this has been imposed on purpose, whether it be through the Supreme Court or through major media. It's always done by force. You know, liberalism, both in its broad sense and its more specific sense in America, always has to be imposed by force, and it can never be honest about its goals. It may use the sophomoric rhetoric of equality, something like that, but the minute they gain any kind of foothold, they will then impose their views through the barrel of a gun, which is what's happening now. Donald Trump, you have a situation where the average American, a zombie for a long time, is seeing on TV illegal immigrants and their friends rioting and attacking policemen, attacking Trump supporters, because Donald Trump is demanding, and his followers are demanding, that American law be enforced and illegal immigrants be deported, and those who have brought them here prosecuted. When you see something like that, and you see the elites in both political parties, the elites in media and in academia defending the illegals, being extreme is now the only way to get anyone's attention. The stagnant, disgusting, middle-of-the-road stuff, people think that to be electable, you have to pretty much believe in nothing. That's ending. The United States is deeply polarized between nationalists and individualists in one form or another, between nationalists and globalists. You know, this is where the divide is. The old paradigms and the old labels don't make any sense. Sometimes we still use the labels, liberals or conservatives, but they really no longer apply. In fact, even words like private and public no longer apply. When corporations control the state, they control politicians. When banks are the only reason that the state is solvent, because the state constantly needs banks for its credit to function even for a few minutes, you have a completely privatized government. But it doesn't end there, because so much government work is done through private contractors. So on both ends of the scale, you have a completely privatized regime. I don't even like referring to the American government, or President Obama or President Clinton or whatever, because they don't have much power. The people who control the banks, people who control media, people who control telecommunications, these are the people who matter. And of course, they're never elected. Real democracy, of course, seems to suggest that those with power, public power, should be elected and overseen by voters. But of course, those with power and real meaning, real overwhelming power over society, are never elected. And most Americans have no idea who runs these corporations and for what purpose. I was very happy to be a part of the Workers' Party conference in Philadelphia. I spoke at their Harrisburg conference several months ago. And there I dealt with the Anti-Federalists and why the American Constitution, the way it was initially signed, was a disaster, and how it led to our present situation. Everything, every problem, and I've said this before, many years ago on this show, that everything that the Anti-Federalists have predicted have come true, including the IRS. You know, they didn't use the name, but a body collecting taxes that had the ability to look into everything you do was predicted. And, of course, they were made fun of. There's no way that this could happen under this Constitution. And, of course, everything that they predicted. They predicted judicial review, that that Supreme Court justices will be the ultimate power in government. No law is valid without their okay, and they can do as they please. Congress could check the Supreme Court by simply saying that there's certain areas of law that they may not oversee. That's possible, but they refuse to do it. So in that conference, I really dealt with the fact that ideas are not sufficient, that the Anti-Federalists really hold the key to understanding American history and where we are right now from a secular political point of view. On a few days ago at the conference, same organization in Philadelphia, I stressed the idea that optimism is now rational. But Donald Trump in America, continuing, I should say, that what Pat Buchanan started and many before him, on the one hand, and Vladimir Putin in Russia, as well as the new governments in eastern Ukraine, and as always, Lukashenko in Belarus, that they are now two, for an American, two poles of a radical revolution in global life, in global politics. But this is a very, very, very good thing. For many years, for decades, I just assumed that the political door has been shut to us, and that from that point of view, from the point of view of public policy, we just simply have to suffer. We have to deal with the fact that these are the end times, and that might not be the case. The end times is on no timetable. The Protestant morons who do all these mathematical calculations from the Book of Daniel, trying to figure out when the end is, somehow believe that God is determined by these timetables, and that he is subject to them. One way you know that someone's a phony is when they start talking about the Bible and they start believing that numbers that they read are actual numerals, that the number four means primarily four of something, rather than what it really means, a prison. Four is the number of sides in a square. It is the prison. It is a box. There is no escape from that box. Four is always a number of death. It's one of the worst numbers, icons. The symbolism of number four is terrible. So wandering in the desert for 40 years doesn't mean that precisely 40 years they wandered in the wilderness. But that's not the case. They wandered in a death-like state for a very long time. The minute you start hearing them refer to numbers the way we do, you know they don't know what they're talking about. In the prophecy of Jonah, you had the case where the capital, the Assyrian Empire, Nineveh, was condemned by God. As always, it was condemned by God for usury, the domination of banks, homosexuality, fornication, really the typical list of things that God destroys a society for. Jonah is sent to Nineveh to preach to them and say that you have to repent. If you don't, God will destroy the city. For some reason, Jonah was so powerful, there was something so wrong with that society that they believed him. And they fasted and they prayed and they did what Jonah did not expect, and God did not destroy the city, making Jonah very upset. Now I look like a moron because I said that they were going to be destroyed and now they're not. We should take that very seriously. They prayed, they fasted, God didn't destroy the city. When God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, he was willing to save it just for a few righteous people, which they could not find. So this may well be the end times. That doesn't mean that the end times actually has to reach its fruition. The end times, the way that it's spoken of in Daniel, in Revelations, and elsewhere, and Church Fathers, we have a situation in the world where it fits every single criteria. And especially since only recently has anything really been global in scope. If it isn't global in scope, then it can't be the end times. That doesn't mean that it has to happen. The blood, for example, of the new martyrs in Russia may have been sufficient to allow God to have the world continue anyway, for better or for worse. So there is no timetable for this. But for many years, I just assumed that was the case, and that it's all over, and really nothing from a political point of view can ever happen. But I'm very proud to be wrong. I never really preached that point of view. I was always very political in my writing and everything, but I never thought that really anything could happen. And then I began corresponding with people at the Traditionalist Workers' Party. I began seeing a group of young people who were highly intelligent, motivated. If society were normal, they would be winners. But there's no room for them in this society. There is no opportunity, outside of a few positions. Women who are the aristocracy of the postmodern world, who have a position in society, if they're attractive and hardworking, there's nothing they could do. They can't do. They are an aristocracy. They rule almost without any kind of restraint. Affirmative action is mostly for women, not for blacks or Hispanics. Either way, what jobs are left are primarily being given to those who support the regime. Affirmative action demands, as well as mass immigration, both legal and illegal. And the new visa regime brings in workers for what good jobs are left are for those who will not make noise, who will not unionize, and who will work for less. Many of you are aware of the Disney debacle, where that company forced its employees to train its foreign replacements. So here you have mass immigration explicitly brought in to take the jobs of white Americans at the Disney Corporation, and those white Americans, in order to qualify for their severance, had to train their foreign, recently immigrated replacements. Now, that's how blatant it was, and at least it became pretty infamous, and some of these people testified before Congress that it was so outrageous. And the worst part is that the system, which Disney is a very strong part, was so comfortable with this that they thought they could do it and not hide it, and nothing would happen. I almost gave up entirely when Americans who had been completely defrauded by the banks, the banks were profiting from the debt bubble that they had created. It came crashing down in 2007, and then the American taxpayer yet again was defrauded, because now they had to cough up about $1 trillion to bail the banks out of the investments that profited them but destroyed many thousands in America. When Americans were forced to bail out the banks and did nothing, I figured then it was over. And it's true, there are reasons to be pessimistic. Americans believe that they are free, they believe they are educated, they believe that they cannot be fooled. And that's the worst place. That's the worst place to be. That's where arrogance and a lack of introspection will get you. They don't think they can be fooled. When they did nothing about that, I threw up my hands. But now I'm seeing some changes. The Soviet Union fell and collapsed overnight. No one predicted it except for Solzhenitsyn. And as I've said before, the CIA in 1990 was talking about how strong the Soviet economy is and how they're going to make the transition to light industry and everything else. And no one predicted it, and it collapsed in a very brief period of time. What was once considered this monolithic global empire imploded. It's not like there was even a war going on. It simply imploded of its own weight. If that can happen, if something like that can happen so radically, then our situation can change radically. And I think we're seeing, I hope that we're seeing this now. Donald Trump, and not just him as a man, he's deeply flawed. As a man, I'm much less interested than what he represents. He represents what Americans really want. At their best, they are anti-federalists. At their best, they want closed borders. They want a level playing field. They reject free trade. They reject laissez-faire. And they realize that economics is only quantitative. And sometimes economists really believe that quantitative figures are all that exists. They don't realize that something like unemployment destroys the psyche. That when an entire town disappears, that leaves a scar on the society as a whole, on the individuals who have to suffer. It has an impact on things like substance abuse, domestic violence, suicide, very low self-esteem. These are endemic. And so we need to get away from the economic point of view that these things are just numbers. 9%, but you know, they will be retrained somehow. But the only job growth in America is in the service industry, things like waitresses, bartenders. And the only sectors, that are doing well, of course, is law. Lawyers always have their piece of the pie. Healthcare, which I need to deal with in another show because it's such a massive industry, which makes very little sense to me. And finance. And of course, you know, holding them all together is computer science. Many of these things are still being shipped abroad. Many of them are being done by foreigners. And so American wages are falling. Immigration, as well as feminism, was altered deliberately in the 1970s when American white male wages were at their peak. To increase profits, the labor pool had to be increased. The more qualified workers, the lower their price. Feminism and immigration came into existence. The radical changes in 1964 came into existence, and then feminism dovetailed within that 10-year period, 64 to 74. And now we're seeing what happened. Wages are falling. They're not just stagnant, they're falling. Productivity of the American worker is extraordinary. If American productivity, labor productivity, kept up with their wages, the minimum wage today would be something like close to $100. If you use, it's like $1.50 when it first came out in 1966, the minimum wage. If you compare that to American productivity, you see a massive amount of exploitation because wages are nowhere near the increases in labor productivity over that period of time. That American labor productivity is far greater than what they're being paid in every sense of the word. Depending on who you read, the minimum wage should be anywhere between $70 and $100 if it were to keep up with increases in production and productivity. Obviously, that's not the case. So where did that extra value go? It went to profits. It went to the oligarchy. No one can defend the present system. And that brings me to my topic. And that is the social nationalist movement in Russia during World War II. More should be done about this. Of course, General Vlasov is well known. His ideology was more vague. But with people like Bronislav Kaminsky, you see what could have happened in Russia. You see what the Germans were fostering, and also, unfortunately, what the Germans were persecuting. I have said on this show a million times, and I'll say it one more time here. Adolf Hitler lost World War II because of his treatment of the Slavs. When the Germans invaded Stalin's Russia, most of the population rose up to support them. This is especially the case in Ukraine. They were exhausted and abused. But they were also willing to fight for the Germans. And not just in Ukraine, but wherever they went. And the Red Army was maintained only by the political faction, which was attached to each unit in the rear, where they would then shoot any deserters. General Vlasov was only one element. There was a huge upsurge of support for the German invasion. Not so much a support for German National Socialism, but the people who were fighting Stalin were overwhelmingly Christians, nationalists, agrarians. not necessarily, you know, you could be a National Socialist and not be in favor of Hitler, in the same sense that you could be a communist and not be a Stalinist. I'm a National Socialist, a social nationalist. A lot of Hitler's errors were, and moral behavior in certain areas were awful. And this error was the worst. He turned allies into enemies when he appointed Eric Koch to run Ukraine for him. Koch persecuted the Ukrainian nationalists to a great degree. He took what should have been allies and turned them into enemies. Regardless, we're talking about two groups: the Russian People's Liberation Army (RONA), which is the Kaminsky Brigade, and then the National Socialist Labor Party of Russia. And this was specifically in charge of this Lokot, L-O-K-O-T, to look it up, social experiment in the Bryansk Forest. It was an autonomous part of the Russian state, about 500,000 people. After the German invasion, of course, they supported the attack. They were very anti-Stalinist. It was always a very prosperous area. And because in that part, it was this extremely well-protected area and always did well, even in the Tsarist period and before. It was a prosperous part of Russia and was always one of the most anti-red parts of Russia. So you have Bronislav Kaminsky, the commander here. The brigade is named after him. And then more broadly, the National Socialist Labor Party, which was manifest to a great extent in the Lokot experiment. They had an army that they formed almost spontaneously after the invasion. Their demand, of course, was the overthrow of Stalin to create a sovereign state for Russians, but also self-determination for others, including Ukrainians. The National Socialists were also opposed to class rule, that oligarchy is illegitimate. Oligarchy is the rule of money. That is to say that money is both necessary and sufficient for being a member of the ruling class. Class rule in the sense that the people like me use it. Class has nothing to do with money. Aristocracy has nothing to do with how much property you own. It's simply a state of mind. It's a matter of the integrity of the personality. You have integralism in the psyche, integralism in the state. They formed their own armed services and intelligence. At their peak, 1943, they had about 12,000 men at arms. They had, they permitted absolutely no alcohol. They did have a collective farm system, but that was strictly the property of those who worked it. And they restored the old peasant commune. Young people were extremely excited about this, and all reports talk about their tremendous work. They had been so brutalized, and they were left with almost no morale, that when they saw the possibility of something new, they took a chance, and they worked extremely hard to build the Lokot system. They weren't defending German interests. They were defending their own. They truly believed that in creating this state, they were protecting, and they were doing this. In my opinion, this is exactly what they were doing. They were preserving the old free way of Russian life. The German-occupied areas, with some exceptions, towns, had great independence. They did have some local control, and the deal that was worked out was that German soldiers were fed in exchange for protection, training, and weapons. And the Germans often, they didn't know the language, they didn't understand what the difference was between a Russian who was a member of the party and a Russian who was a counter-revolutionary. They burned villages, they killed POWs, they did the wrong thing. They did also, however, lower taxes. The RONA served as police agents against Red guerrillas in the German rear. There are some reports that some German soldiers assisted them in farm work, especially in August when it was necessary. But their ignorance, unfortunately, ended up dividing the two peoples. Kaminsky was set up as ruler. but the Germans misused the RONA. By the time the Germans realized that the Slavs needed to be mobilized and essentially left alone, because if they were left alone, they would mobilize and fight Stalin just by themselves, it was already too late. By the time anything really was sanctioned by the Germans, it was already February, March of 1945. And a slight majority of were Belarusian civilians. Remember something else. Warfare brutalizes a population. And warfare, really, especially in the 20th century, warfare, when you see death, when you see killings, when you see the constant carnage that war produces and the morality that it produces, it destroys your sense of self. Immorality, immoral behavior, egotistical behavior, irrational behavior start becoming the norm. This is something that people forget in any war-torn society. People also forget that the psyche is badly damaged. All senses of morality are gone. And I said this with the Taliban in Afghanistan. But that society had been plunged into war for so long, their sense of personal morality was non-existent. And the Taliban made sense to me because they were very, very strict, very harsh, and violent, which in reorganizing that dying, bleeding society was absolutely required. And very much like the Russian rejection of alcohol here, the Taliban destroyed, using flamethrowers, the opium crop of the country. Once the Taliban were eliminated, of course, that opium crop was restored, and the American government, military, and CIA have profited handsomely, supplying the rest of the world with heroin. Often, even for Kaminsky himself, he wasn't used at the front. He was used as a policeman in Poland. And the Germans killed him after the Warsaw Uprising. They completely misused and mistreated their Slavic allies, and it cost them the war. The war was decided in Russia. Russia has been the center of the world for a very, very long time. The reason for that. The World War II was, at its core, a war between Germany and Russia, or between National Socialism and International Socialism. But because of how warfare breaks the psyche, any rebuilding required a great degree of strictness and severity. The National Socialist Labor Party of Russia had its moral vision imposed violently. And this is the case, unfortunately, wherever you go. That's the nature of a rebuilding after after warfare. When you see, especially when you grow up with it, this constant chaotic world, you have to be rebuilt. You have to be rebuilt slowly but surely. Youth groups were formed because they were really the core of all of this. They believed in equality from an economic point of view, that opportunity should be the same, and outside of, you know, radical differences in ability, outcomes should be the same. Nation implied equality. Nationalism implied socialism. Germans, however, viewed Likud as, they viewed it suspiciously. Ultimately, in Ukraine, the autocephalous Orthodox Church was banned, even though that movement had strongly supported Adolf Hitler's invasion. It's true that the Synod outside of Russia, based in New York, also did, but not nearly with the great enthusiasm that the autocephalous Ukrainians did. That meant nothing. People like Eric Cook didn't realize that. They didn't speak the language. They didn't understand the history. And they viewed essentially all Slavs either as inferiors or communists. He was a military dictator, and he was not sympathetic in a lot of the things that he did, including his actions in Poland. But the most important thing, the best thing that he can be credited with, was developing of the RONA's infrastructure right up until 1945. The only real German support he got was from Goebbels, who was very enthusiastic and very excited about this program, but people like Himmler and Koch were vehemently opposed to. In 1943, Germans condemned any form of nationalism, whether it be in Belarus, Russia, or Ukraine. When the Germans first invaded, the people in this region, more than any other region, took up arms to defend their society against looters, and how red groups, anarchist groups, were trying to use the invasion for their own purposes. Their armed units, by the time the initial euphoria of the invasion had ended, were now experienced fighters. What people don't really realize about this is that they had carved out their free state 2 weeks before the Germans arrived. Because of its protected nature, the Brionsk Forest, they were capable of removing the Reds from their area by force of arms before the Germans even invaded. It's conceivable that they knew that something was going to happen. The population of the area is about 500,000. It's in the Orel region. It's about Idrist district, we would say today. But the other person, I shouldn't say Goebbels was the only person. General Hans Gordon, was very sympathetic to the group, at least in that they provided a great degree of stability to the rear. The supply lines were maintained. He gave Lecourt full autonomy. In fact, the society, this social experiment, didn't contain any Germans at all. Not as a matter of, there was any kind of prejudice there. But Hans Gordon believed that it should be a Russian enclave and possibly a blueprint for a future national socialist Russia. Kaminsky's view is an identical with that of the National Socialist Labor Party, but they were close. Like most nationalists worldwide, they believed in private property, but like anything else, it's not an absolute. Private property is legitimate to the extent that it serves the common good. This is a wealthy region. There are minerals and forest products. There were already large enterprises under local ownership. Land was given to peasants without rent, but it was also not, cannot alienate it. It was not sellable. There was free agricultural trade. And by February of 1942, the average peasant holding in this social experiment was about 24 acres. Taxes were very low, and yet they had a full array of social services available. The elderly and disabled, those who were poor, through no fault of their own, lived tax-free. They had a state bank, and this state bank was in charge of planning the development. They did not control the economy, but they did control the currency through the political organization itself. Reading rooms, lectures, education was an essential part of this. Of course, it's an Orthodox state, but that wasn't necessarily an official doctrine. They had 345 schools by the middle of 1943 and 9 hospitals total with different specializations. Abortion was absolutely banned, and divorce was very difficult to get. Local Jews were never harmed, but they were banned from having anything to do with the economic functioning of the society. The nation was only as legitimate in their eyes as the prosperity of each individual unit. It was the same language, ethnicity, and faith. One single idea. Without it, you could have no nation. You could have no politics at all. Spirit, labor, had to be in balance. Body, soul, spirit. Materialism was out of the question. So was idealism. They did not receive subsidies from Germany. And yet, it remained the single most prosperous area under German occupation. And its force was largely a volunteer force. 1943, the NKVD hit the area. And what they came up against was about 12,000 men, most of whom were experienced, 24 T-34s, 36 field guns competently maintained, and 8 armored cars. Some of this was German, some of this was Soviet. Making them compatible was always difficult, but they did have, in one way or another, all the weaponry they needed. The German army in that region was fed and their supplies were taken care of, so long as they received weapons and training and protection from the army. But it was understood that this was an autonomous body. RONA was one of the most successful combat units of World War II. Minsky was an SS brigadier general, and at least to that extent, was taken very seriously by Berlin. His position ultimately was to be a policeman in Warsaw, which suggests that his rank didn't exactly correspond with his duties. But being sent out of Russia into Poland was a bad idea and shows really that they didn't trust Russians. They didn't trust this kind of social organization, even though people like Hans Gerdian saw this as a godsend. He believed in, and they, I should say, believed in free land. No one should ever be able to buy or rent land. If you're capable, especially in Russia, if you're capable of farming it, then you should have it as much as you need. As I said, the average was about 24 acres per family, but at an absolute minimum, 2 acres, 2.5 acres was legally mandated. You can never go below that. There was a free market. And in fact, anybody's personal fortune there, any individual, was limited to 5 million gold rubles. So there was a ceiling as well as a floor in terms of your income. The industry that developed there developed quickly, were very competent, and they had a 2-month leave from work if you worked in something very dangerous, steel, forestry. These industries, being dangerous, required that. 2 months leave was mandated for everybody who worked there. They had the free use of the forest. Wood is not something they had any problem with. Anybody who had been a member of the party and who had publicly repented was granted amnesty. They had to be very, very careful. But many people had joined the party only because that was the only way to get any kind of work, the only way that they could really be anything in society. They had to make it very, very clear that that's really why they were members of the party, and they were granted amnesty if that were the case. There is actually this question. Someone emailed me not too long ago that Bronislaw Kaminsky was Russian Orthodox. In fact, this entire movement was religious, even though they held to freedom of religion in the sense that state policy wasn't connected to the church. But it didn't mean that the concepts of justice weren't part of the church's role in that society. He was canonized by one faction of the catacomb church, the faction of Onsieverts, the 6th of June 2005. I don't know off the top of my head what happened with that faction. They canonized actually certain supporters of his as well, St. Constantine, the man who wrote the Manifesto of the People's Socialist Party of Russia, which is you know, some of the ideology and the reality of what I spoke about came from. And no one else had followed him in that respect. These were strict Orthodox people, but whether or not they should be canonized is another matter. So how do we summarize this? Apparently before the German invasion, about 2 weeks before the German invasion, the very prosperous citizens, 500,000 in the Bryansk Forest, which became the Likud social experiment, rose up against the Reds and threw out the commissars. There's no apparent consequences to them for this. This was a very, very prosperous area, a protected area. Someone must have known that they're going to be delivered very soon. The Germans invaded. They wiped out the old commissars. They destroyed the old system for a while. And what was already in the process of being built now got a boost, and the Likud community was created. it was based on National Socialism in the sense that it was ethnic, and the ethnic connection and the tradition of the peoples, what makes a Russian, especially there, was stressed. But that also implies the notion that each individual, to the extent that they are healthy, physically and mentally, is as equal, an equal part of that as any other. There is differences in terms of function, but within those functions, of course, there is inequality. All policemen are not equal. Some who have been around for a long time and have distinguished themselves are better than others. But only in that respect is inequality permitted. There was a 5 million ruble ceiling, as well as a floor of 1 hectare or 2.4 acres. This was a prosperous area, both in terms of its wheat productivity, forest, and minerals. Large enterprises were under state ownership. This includes enterprises that had existed prior to the invasion, as well as several that sprung up afterwards. In areas under German control, economic development was extraordinary. And it had nothing to do with anything that the Germans did. In fact, the Germans hindered some of this. The German behavior was very unsympathetic almost throughout. Not necessarily because of policy, although in Himmler's case, he made it very explicit what he wanted to do with Slavs, but often because of the language barrier and the ignorance of Russian history. The Germans invade, and this movement now becomes institutionalized. And it's ruled over by Bronislaw Kaminsky, RONA, and the National Socialist Party, kind of dovetails and corresponds in this particular case to create a, not so much a utopian community, but because of the tremendous relief and euphoria that this movement had for young people, especially the invasion of Germans, these are, they're finally free of the terror, which had just, you know, this in the 1930s, so 1941, 42, this was a huge relief. That euphoria created an engine for extraordinary production and work. This was as close to a utopian experiment as possible. It worked. It succeeded. There's absolutely no question about it. Land was free. Homes were free. So long as you were willing to work. Currency was under the state. Taxes were paid only by those who worked. Those who couldn't work for no fault of their own were handled by the state. But since they had also resurrected the commune, as well as made the collective farm more sensible, these institutions really, as well as the church itself, took care of poor relief. Education was the primary goal. And so many of the profits went into building a huge network of schools. In terms of building a nationalist, socialist, and orthodox society, the reading rooms and lectures, it was about creating a new order. Of course, they're bringing back so much that was good about the Tsarist era, as well as the Kievan era. History was a huge part of the curriculum. From a military point of view, they were a godsend to the Germans, and this was Hans Gurion's idea. They kept the peace so long as the contract, sort of informal contract, was observed. They never had to worry about supplies. They never had to worry about the locals. They never had to worry about any kind of subversion. Bronislaw Kaminsky was a true leader. Despite his name, he was Russian. He was Orthodox. And he saw military rule, at least for the time being, as absolutely essential. All they really needed to do was allow the Slavs to simply organize on their own. The state here came second. The state wasn't even important. What was happening was communes, the churches, hospitals, schools came together, formed spontaneously. And all they really needed was the confidence that it would not be destroyed. There is no reason to work if you think that your effort is not going to last more than a few days. The state was a military one. It wasn't too different from the old Cossack organization. But one of the most important elements is that the individual is a fiction of Western capitalism, was rejected. The only thing that mattered, the foundation of society, was the family. When I say family, I'm not referring to the nuclear family. That's also a modern idea. The family is in reference to the extended family. We call the extended family today. That was a primary organization of social life as well as economic life. They didn't make any distinctions between spiritual life, cultural life, economic life. And that's not just because they're in the process of rebuilding. But as always the case, warfare destroys the psyche of a population. They're always dealing with broken people. And not just because of the invasion and the war, but also because a lot of these people had to deal with Stalin's purges and had lived in the Soviet Union. They were willing to hear the case of party members who were willing to repent publicly. But the old commissars, the political commissars, were executed. They were used for reconnaissance of the German army. They were used as a police force. And they, as it turns out, were first-class guerrillas. A lot of partisans and communist guerrillas caused the Germans a lot of problems. The only way to fight that was to have guerrilla units of their own. And here is where the RONA was of tremendous help. And they were abused, misused by the German forces. Other than Goebbels and General Gurdjieff, they were seen as a possible competitor with the Germans. This was an orthodox state. This was a state that had private property in the true sense of the word. You can't have private property and oligarchy at the same time. Modern capitalism rejects private property. When I say property, I don't mean, you know, your backyard. I'm referring to capital. The machine, the things that you make things with. Private property does not refer to your toothbrush. That's personal property. Private property refers to capital. And that should be in private hands, but large industries, strategic industries, should be under state control. There's a big difference between state ownership and state control. To the extent that the state has a common good in mind, there is absolutely nothing wrong with either state ownership or state control. But in this case, not only because it's a small society, because it's in a severe condition, it's in a war-torn condition, it had just gone through the Stalinist era, it's going to be very strict, and state control is going to be substantial. What would have happened afterwards, we don't know. And for me, the most impressive part of this is that it was almost totally spontaneous. You simply needed to let them go. You know, that they had to have confidence that peace was going to be long-lasting on the one hand, and that they had the freedom to work on the other. And these institutions rebuilt themselves. With the exception of the industry that already existed, there were many that developed, and that these, especially among the youth, were spontaneous organizations. And this is what created this prosperity. So in the midst of the war, in the midst of Stalinist insanity, as the West was almost near death because of the Depression, the Lukoc experiment showed that National Socialism could work, that it is a spiritual movement, that certainly this is the ideology of the prophets of the Orthodox Church. And the Orthodox Church in Germany, in exile, the Catacomb Church, the Church in Ukraine, Church in Belarus, were all firmly National Socialist in their basic economic point of view at the time. Because the National Socialist movement in Russia, particularly this experiment, was very close to the Mosaic Doctrine in Deuteronomy, especially with the idea of the family being the center of the economy and there being a strong sense of equality. Nationalism implies socialism, and that was a sense, maybe the slogan, the motto of this movement. There was tremendous economic growth without subsidies from Germany, and in some cases, really without assurances that the Germans would not do damage to this. But they did it anyway. it was almost a therapy for these people. The fact that it was done before the German invasion, a few days before the German invasion, is extraordinary. And it was destroyed largely because Germany lost the war. Even before Germany lost the war, though, they were misusing and abusing these people, and had the racial ideas and the ability of the military authorities to interact with the Slavs been better. Had Eric Koch been fired, had people like Gurdjieff been taken seriously, things could have been different. Instead, Stalin won the war. All of these sorts of movements were destroyed. And because of the U.S. and Great Britain distracting the Germans and, of course, destroying the Japanese Empire, Stalin was able to create his Gulag society from the Pacific Ocean all the way to Berlin. With the deaths of God knows how many millions of Orthodox people, the Americans fought on the wrong side. Any fool can see that. General Patton said that. There would have been no Korea. There would have been no Vietnam. There would have been no arms race. There would have been no anti-war movement in the 60s, Frankfurt School in America. None of this would have existed. Instead, because of destruction of Hitler, which meant, at least in the popular mind, the general destruction of anything like nationalism, the world was divided between Gulag socialism on the one hand and capitalist technocracy on the other hand. So liberalism and socialism divided up the world between them. This was the so-called Good War, which permitted the deaths of God knows how many millions. We'll never know the full number of the millions that were killed in the Gulag system, killed in the Soviet system, not just because they were shot or that they were sent to prison, but because they had no reason to work. They had no reason to live. What difference does it make what I do? The commissars could take it tomorrow. Why am I going to invest in my life? What difference does it make what happens to my kids? They could end up in a Gulag tomorrow, or I could end up in there with them. The scars of this system, I think maybe only now, are going to heal. It's taken a long time for these scars to heal, and that's not taken into consideration by political science or economics in these times. The destruction of the psyche living under this society, including those of us who live under oligarchy, who live under an imperial oligarchic empire, our scars are very, very severe. So I will end this here. I thank you for listening. I think more work needs to be done on Kaminsky and his movement. I want to thank all my friends. I want to thank the Barnes Review, as always. I want to thank the Traditionalist Workers' Party and Matt Heimbeck, as always. And I want to thank our enemies. You are stupid. You're misinformed. You're just trying to curry the favor of the regime. But on occasion, you do keep us honest. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.